I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Charles Best, founder of Donors Choose, an online philanthropic marketplace that connects donors to public school teachers who request supplies for their classroom projects across the United States. These supplies range from glue to microscopes, instruments, and books. Charles started Donors Choose in 2000 while he was a public school teacher in the Bronx who faced his own shortage of supplies for the projects he wanted to create with his students. The organization has raised over $300 million from more than 1.5 million citizen philanthropists, benefiting almost 15 million students. Welcome.
Thank you.
How does Donors Choose work?
So we do three things to ensure the integrity of our philanthropic marketplace. First, we vet and authenticate each classroom project before it's posted to the public site. Second, when the project is funded, we don't give cash to the teacher. We purchase the resources and have them delivered to the classroom. And then finally, every teacher for every project publishes photos of the project in action, a thank you note, an impact letter, a cost report showing how every dollar was spent, and students write those thank you letters.
How did the idea of Donors Choose first come to you?
Well, I was a history teacher at a high school in the Bronx for 5 years. And during my first year of teaching, my colleagues and I would spend a lot of our own money on copy paper and pencils and other supplies. And we would talk in the teacher's lunchroom about books that we wanted our students to read and a field trip we wanted to take them on and a pair of microscopes that we needed for a science experiment. And I just kind of figured that there must be people out there who'd want to help teachers like us if they could see exactly where their money was going. So that spawned the idea.
It spawned the idea, but there wasn't lots of crowdsourcing at the time in 2000 when you started Donors Choose. How did you think about the mechanics of this idea specifically?
Yeah, crowdfunding was years away from even being a word. And actually, when we did launch, the only comparison point was to eBay. People would refer to us as a philanthropic eBay for teachers and donors to connect. When I sketched out DonorsChoose.org, it was literally with pencil and paper. And so I didn't have a whole lot of online reference points at the time. It was really just the inspiration of my colleagues and sort of just feeling like we ought to tap into all these ideas that teachers like my colleagues had for helping their students. And if we could do that, and if we could then mobilize citizen philanthropists, which also was a term that we kind of invented for purposes of this model. If we could connect those two groups, then my colleagues and I would be able to get our students those books and take them on that field trip and do that science experiment. It was really kind of just gut instinct.
Were you surprised by how little support you had when you came to school?
Well, I'd gone to a private high school where we went on field trips into the woods and we had graphing calculators for trigonometry and the supplies to do just about any art project we didn't want for anything. And then when I started teaching in the Bronx, I saw firsthand that all schools are not created equal. And I was expecting that kind of disparity, that kind of inequity. But the scale of it did surprise me. And I was lucky. I was teaching at a high school that was newly constructed and was a really nice place. But even there, the book that I wanted my students to read was Little House on the Prairie. And my students, even those who had never left New York City, loved this book. But the school system was not about to underwrite copies of Little House on the Prairie for each of my students. And so I would wake up and go to the copy shop, open 24 hours a day every morning before school, and make photocopies of that day's section of Little House on the Prairie, which probably violated a lot of copyright laws. And it was actually then, when I was making those photocopies, that I figured, like, all right, I bet there are people out there who'd want to help us out.
You mentioned you went to private school, private high school. This is St. Paul's, the boarding school. And you funded the first 10 projects or so just as a proof of concept. What were the projects that you put on because you needed the supplies and which you funded anonymously?
Yeah, well, when I had created the first site, version one, it was super rudimentary. I needed to get my colleagues to try out the site and post the first projects. And my mom made a pear dessert that I used to bribe them into creating the first projects. And those first projects were the health teacher seeking baby think it over dolls for a pregnancy prevention unit. These are dolls which cry at 3 a.m. and need to be fed and show a teenager what their responsibilities would be were they to have a kid. And the English teacher wanted to get his students ready for the SAT, so he requested test prep books. The art teacher wanted to do a wall-to-wall quilt with each student sewing a square, for which she needed fabric and thread and needles. And actually, the other history teacher and I, We wanted our students to meet Mokhtar Tayeb, who had been profiled in The New Yorker after escaping from modern-day slavery in Mauritania. And our students had just finished reading the autobiography of Frederick Douglass, and we thought how amazing it would be if our students could meet someone in person who himself had escaped from slavery. And so our project was to bring in Mokhtar Tayeb so our students could meet this man. And those were four of the first 10 projects created on our site.
Why did your mom have to incentivize the teachers to put their projects?
Well, because at the time, you know, this was a site that was totally unproven. I didn't actually know any donors. And so I was asking my colleagues to take an hour out of their days. Mm-hmm. And I figured I would need to give them a material incentive to do that, since from their perspective, they presumed that they were just kind of spending an hour as a favor to me and that their classroom request would not actually be fulfilled.
And to their surprise, it was fulfilled by you.
My aunt, who's a nurse, funded the first project. But after that one, I didn't know any more donors. And so I did have to fund my colleagues' projects myself. But I did so anonymously. And that made my colleagues mistakenly think that the website actually worked. And that rumor spread across the Bronx, prompting hundreds of other teachers to create projects on our site, projects that needed a whole lot more money than what I could afford to fund. And by the way, I could only afford to fund even those first 10 projects because I was still living at home with my parents and they weren't charging me any rent, so I could spare some of my teacher salary.
Speaking of teacher salary, did you have the expectation upon graduating from Yale that you wanted to be a teacher for the long term? Or what was your ambition professionally? Or did you not know?
I knew I wanted to be a teacher since I was in high school. I had this English teacher and wrestling coach. His name was Mr. Buxton, and he was just an inspiration. I figured that if anybody ever looked up to me the way that I looked up to Mr. Buxton, I would have done my share in life. And so since I was in high school, I knew I wanted to be a teacher.
What did your parents do?
My dad was a lawyer, and my mom raised me and my brother.
And your dad had a stroke 20 years ago, which precluded him from practicing law. So how did your family support itself after that?
Well, my dad had worked hard enough and been successful enough to have enough of a pension, enough of a nest egg to be able to support him. And so I still consider myself lucky in terms of the upbringing I've had and the resources available to me.
Did you feel like your home life in any way influenced, you know, what you're doing now? Were you civic minded or?
Well, my parents did always encourage me to pursue whatever job I would most enjoy doing and have fun at. There was never any pressure to take whatever job would make the most money. So in that sense, I have them to thank for feeling liberated and encouraged to be a teacher.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charles Best, founder of Donors Choose, a philanthropic marketplace connecting public school teachers who request supplies for their classrooms with citizen philanthropists, members of the public who make contributions. You mentioned that word spread throughout the Bronx. How quickly did that word spread across the Bronx in the early days?
It spread pretty quickly. Within just a few months of launching the site, there must have been at least 50 projects created by other teachers in the Bronx at other schools. And I did not know how I was going to get those funded. But my students volunteered after school for about 4 months to help me out.
What grade?
These were 10th and 11th graders. And I think they could see the potential of this experiment to change their lives at school. I think they also felt bad for me. And so that's why they volunteered for several months to spread word to potential donors. And they addressed and compiled 2,000 letters by hand to people all over the country telling them about this website where someone with $10 could be a hero. And we sorted the mail ourselves because we wanted to get the cheapest postal rate. And so like every desk in my classroom was piled high with letters. And then we carted the sorted letters to the post office, crossed our fingers, and it worked. My students' letter writing campaign generated $30,000 in donations to projects on our site.
Whom were those letters sent to? Just friends of your students or relatives of your students?
They were actually the alumni directories of the high school and college that I had gone to, which I'm not sure was strictly legal, but what was forbidden was mechanical reproduction of the addresses. And so by handwriting every address, I felt that that was manual reproduction. direction and that we would be just safe of the authorities. And actually, my students had fun. You could see what jobs people had, and my students decided that they needed to write letters to all of the lawyers and doctors who had gone to Yale, and so they sent them letters.
Interesting that you used a very old school mechanism or means to galvanizing support of a very new school, online, innovative system. Did you think about that?
Well, you could think of DonorsChoose.org as a bit of a new school surface to an old school core. When a donor funds a project on our site, they get a thank you note. They get photos of the project taking place that are digitally published to the project page. But then the best thing they get are handwritten student thank you letters. And we've strategically decided to keep those student thank you letters old school, physical, analog. And if you ask someone who's been on our site to recollect their experience, what they will immediately remember is that they got handwritten thank you letters from the students.
By the way, were you a thank you note family? Were you deep into that? I mean, I have some friends who write thank you notes for every little thing, you know, versus others who might just send a nice email. Where was your family on that spectrum?
My mom would not have told you that I lived up to any standard of thank you note writing, but at least I knew that there was such a standard, even if I was not living up to it.
I want to talk about supporters more generally. The site was successful due to word of mouth for the first 2 or 3 years, and then you had a real pop in popularity in 2003 when Oprah Winfrey discovered you. Could you tell me about that pivot moment?
Sure. Well, after 9/11, a lot of the teachers at the public schools beside Ground Zero created projects on our site to recover from the attacks on the World Trade Center. And the first reporter to pay any attention to these projects was Jonathan Alter of Newsweek at the time. And he would later write a one-paragraph blurb about this philanthropic experiment growing out of a Bronx classroom that Oprah Winfrey's producers caught. And so in 2003, Oprah did just a lovely story about our site. I can remember that my students were on the best behavior I had ever seen them exhibit when Oprah's car came to come get me after school. And her story really inspired a lot of people, not just to donate to classroom projects on our site, but to ask about whether our site could expand to other parts of the country.
You had such an acceleration in traffic that I believe, did the site crash? Is that right? Or what happened?
Our site melted down when Oprah talked about DonorsChoose.org. I think at one moment there were 17,000 people within the same half second who were simultaneously trying to access our site, and it fell down. But we did get back up, and about $250,000 of donations were made to classroom projects.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charles Best, founder of Donors Choose. We'll hear more from Charles coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charles Best, founder of Donors Choose, an online charity that connects citizen philanthropists, members of the public, with public school teachers in all 50 states. Charles started Donors Choose in 2000 while he was a public school teacher in the Bronx and had to use his own money to pay for supplies for his students. And then in 2007, Stephen Colbert becomes a supporter, and he's a member of your board. How did he find out about the project?
Well, back in 07, 08, Stephen decided to enter the South Carolina Democratic presidential primary. And he faced, I think, a bit of a challenge, which was that members of the Colbert Nation wanted to support Stephen, wanted to financially support his candidacy. But I'm sure that in Stephen's mind, he didn't want his viewers and supporters giving their hard-earned money to a campaign that at least at some level was satire. And yet he needed to give them an outlet. And what he did was he launched a philanthropic presidential straw poll on DonorsChoose.org where you could donate to a classroom project in honor of your favorite candidate, basically a philanthropic contest between candidate supporters. And Stephen decided that he was going to win that philanthropic presidential straw poll, which he did. People donated almost $80,000 to classroom projects in South Carolina, which pushed Stephen ahead of all the other candidates, both Democrat and Republican.
It's interesting when you're relaying the story, you're almost speaking like he speaks. This might be...
That's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
How did Stephen Colbert find out about you?
I think that was thanks to two people. One was Craig Newmark of Craigslist, who was going on the Colbert Report, and to his incredible generosity, was willing to talk about Craigslist for only a couple of minutes and then spend the rest of his interview talking to Stephen about DonorsChoose.org. And then we also have our board member, Jonathan Alter, to thank, reporter. He, too, managed to I think, whisper in Stephen's ear about this site that he might want to check out.
In addition to the foundations and the Oprahs of the world, I want to talk about individuals who, you know, are anonymous, just members of the public. The smallest donation one can make is a dollar. But there's a story of a woman in California who gave $1.3 million. Can you tell that story briefly?
Yes. Well, I got to work one morning and there was a voicemail that I listened to from a woman, an elderly woman, who sounded like she might just be having trouble making a $5 donation. I called her back just out of courtesy, and she asked how many projects there were on the site from California teachers. And I looked, and there were about 2,100 projects from California. And then she asked how much it would cost to fund them all. And I took out a calculator, and average price of average project costing $600 said, oh, $1.3 million would fund every California classroom request. And she said, okay, and she hung up, and I figured I wouldn't hear from her again. But 3 days later, we got a $1.3 million check in the mail. And on the first day back to school, we were able to fully fund every single California teacher's classroom project request on our site in one magical surprise moment. And the response was just amazing. And the reaction we saw from not just teachers, but even from the general public, even from the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, who called up this woman, and he didn't have his assistant call ahead of him. Arne Duncan just picked up the phone directly, and this woman thought that he must be a prank caller. And so our Secretary of Education had to spend a couple minutes convincing this woman that he was not a prank phone caller.
Did she, by the way, gift repeatedly the following year?
You know, she passed away about 6 weeks later, so that what she did was maybe her last philanthropic act.
The concept of citizen philanthropists, not the ones giving the $1.3 million, but the other ones. What is the demographics, or what is the makeup or the nature of the people contributing?
Our reason for being is the $10 donor who can express a personal passion, like the town where they grew up or the sport they played in high school or their favorite author, and then see classroom projects that match their passion and give to the one that makes their eye twinkle and see where their dollars are going and hear back from the students and teacher they chose to help. So that's our core. That's why we exist. They range in age and background and geography. About half of them are motivated by the cause of educational inequity. And another half of them are on our site because they love the model. The cause of educational inequity isn't as important to them as this new ability to be a full-fledged philanthropist.
What are some of your favorite projects over
the
years?
A lot of favorites. I'll think just recently I was looking at a teacher in Michigan, in a rural, low-income part of Michigan. There's a lake nearby her classroom, and she and her sixth graders have been hatching native lake trout because their lake was terribly polluted a couple decades ago, and they have been hatching native lake trout and reintroducing them to the lake. But they're not certain whether or not the baby lake trout that they're hatching are actually thriving on the stone reef that they installed in the lake to protect those baby trout. And so the teacher was requesting two underwater robots for her students to be able to monitor whether the lake trout fry were actually thriving on this reef.
Which, of course.
I would be incapable of coming up with that project on all sorts of dimensions. And it's an example among thousands of the teachers who use our site not simply to get resources that are urgently needed for their students, but to come up with projects that will bring learning to life that are just totally wild and innovative.
How about another one?
Well, I think also of projects where the teacher is requesting a resource that is of almost mortal consequence. I remember a teacher in North Carolina whose first grade student had died in a fire over the summer because this was a part of North Carolina where a lot of the homes don't have smoke detectors. And this teacher came back to school and created a project requesting 100 smoke detectors for each of her students' classmates to install in their homes and teach their families about fire safety as a sort of kind of living memorial to their fallen classmate. And I think of another teacher in Oakland who had a student with spastic cerebral palsy, a girl named Cindy, who couldn't communicate with her parents or with her friends because of this disability. But Cindy's teacher was able to take Cindy to try a voice output device where with hand controls, you can emit sounds and communicate words. And it turned out that Cindy was able to use this device really successfully and speak with her parents and with her friends for the first time. But her insurance didn't cover this voice output device, which was still kind of experimental. And so her teacher put a project up on Donors Choose that was called Give Cindy a Voice. Mm-hmm. And that was not figurative. It was literally to give Cindy a voice. And there are more projects than most would appreciate that that really get to issues of life and survival and sustenance.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Charles Best, founder of Donors Choose, an online charity that connects citizen philanthropists, members of the public, with public school teachers in all 50 states. Charles started Donors Choose in 2000 while he was a public school teacher in the Bronx and had to use his own money to pay for supplies for his students. You know, it seems like from 10,000 feet, you've had kind of a charmed existence. What was harder for you than you thought? In all of this? I mean, I know that it's still a forced march, even, you know, getting all of the projects funded on Donors Choose, that only, you know, 70% of the projects get funded. But what did you have to kind of course correct?
Well, if I could rewind, there's one thing I would do over, and that is the name Donors Choose. The syllables of which, the sounds of which, do not roll off the tongue easily, nor do they stick to the brain. If I tell someone DonorsChoose.org and ask them 30 minutes later to tell the name back to me, they will struggle to remember it. Or they'll do funny things with it, like call it Donors Choice or Donors.org or who knows what. And I wish I could go back in time and engage a branding naming expert. There's a school of thought that people call the lean startup methodology, which basically posits that when you come up with an idea, you should launch it in its minimally viable form so that you can start getting feedback from customers and users as soon as possible. Do not perfect the thing. Go live with the thing.
And I prototypes, think, basically.
Prototypes, that's right. And I think the one exception to the lean startup school of thought is brand naming, which is a brand name is the one thing that you cannot launch in a minimally viable form and just iterate on as you get feedback from customers. In our case, at least, before you know it, there's been a news story about your site, naming your site, and then you think, well, we can't change the name now because then that we'll never be able to refer anyone to that news story. And so then before you know it, you're locked into that brand name. And so if I could rewind, I would try and do that over.
What might you call it?
You know, clearly it's not just that I was moving too quickly. I'm not good at coming up with brand names because I struggle to answer that question.
What are your children's names?
George and Helen.
And they're stuck with those. Are you happy with those names?
I am. I'm absolutely happy with them.
I want to talk about some other efforts that you've undertaken, one of which was a 2011 hackathon. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So the hackathon gave the American public two opportunities. One was our API, which enables people to build apps using DonorsChoose.org content. Really, it's a way for people to reinvent and reshape and redesign the DonorsChoose.org experience. The other opportunity we gave people was to rock out on our data. And the data refers to all the information attached to all those 600,000 classroom projects that have been funded on our site, created by 250,000 teachers at 60% of all the public schools in the country. And those projects and the mountain of information that each project contains about the latitude and longitude of the school, the poverty rate of the school, the subject area, every book and book title and ISBN number in the project request, every keyword in the project essay, is a mountain of data attached to each project. And in that data, you can find teachers trying to tell the powers that be what resources are most needed in their classrooms. And you can look at this data based on neighborhood or city or state and effectively listen more closely to teachers and see what kindergarten teachers in Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn have in common when it comes to their classroom needs. You can see what technology devices California teachers most need in their classrooms. You could see what books Louisiana sixth grade teachers think are most effective at getting kids hooked on reading, as expressed by the projects that they're creating on our site. We realized that we might be able to give voice to classroom teachers at the budget making or policy making table as a dream. And we figured that our data could provide insights that would enable government officials to more wisely spend education funding dollars.
On your site, you talk about just some of the aspects of this data, and you mentioned before some projects that were your favorite that, you know, were of mortal consequence. And it turns out when teachers use pessimistic language, which in a sense fuels a sense of urgency, versus optimistic language, their projects are more likely to get funded.
That's right. There are all sorts of things we can discover in our data, not just about what teachers most need and what's on teachers' minds, but about this kind of psychological dynamics of citizen philanthropy and of crowdfunding and micro-giving. And we've discovered all sorts of funny and quirky, idiosyncratic things.
What are some of those?
So as one example, we tested using either a heart icon or a star icon for people to save a classroom project to consider later. Think of it as like adding it to your wish list. And when we used a heart icon for people to save a project for later consideration, we saw a material increase in the conversion rate of our overall website. Something about putting a heart out there versus a star really, really gets people. I'll give you one other example. We had read a study showing that people are more likely to donate to hurricane relief if the name of the hurricane is the same as theirs, or even if the name, if the first letter of the hurricane is the same as the first letter of their name. So you, Jessica, are more likely to donate to hurricane relief even for Hurricane John than you are for Hurricane Sarah. Mm. And that prompted us to think, all right, we've got 1.5 million donors, that of course include their names, and we've got 250,000 teachers. Why don't we match these people up based on their last name? And so on Valentine's Day, we sent donors a note saying, roses are red, violets are blue, give to a teacher with the same name as you. And we gave a little PS showing a classroom project from a teacher with the exact same last name as the donor. And donors' response to that email was 3 times greater than their response to a similar poem that showed them a classroom project near to their location. So way more powerful than geo-targeting was name matching. One of a whole bunch of things we've discovered about what excites people to donate.
You alluded to this before a little bit, how you were trying or you were hoping to have some influence on legislation or on budget allocation based on the data and just based on, you know, your own experience at the organization. How successful have you been?
We cannot point to any budget line item in any state or city education allocation that was inspired by our data yet. We hope that within a couple years' time, we will be able to point to millions, and in our dream world, billions of dollars of government education spending that has become smarter, more efficient, more responsive, mm-hmm. because policymakers can now see classroom needs as they emerge in real time.
People have probably ascertained this by now by listening to you, but you have a lot of energy. And you've demonstrated some moxie, even with the photocopying of Little House on the Prairie 30 times. Have you always had the reputation of, yeah, Charles Best, boy, he has lots of energy?
Well, when I was a teacher, The way I maintained discipline in my classroom was by being more enthusiastic about the subject material than my students were about whispering with each other, which was could be an exhausting way of maintaining good discipline in the classroom. I think I lacked the ability to instill fear in teenagers, which would have been maybe more useful. But I do think that maybe the best way to get people behind an effort or get someone to yes is just by being infectiously enthusiastic and by being inquisitive.
What are some other examples of your infectious enthusiasm growing up?
Gosh, the experience growing up that for a weird reason I feel like most relates to Donors Choose Now is all the woodworking I did when I was a kid. My parents didn't have a TV in the house, and I think that left me with some spare time, and I filled it by learning carpentry when I was in kindergarten. I remember going into class with like big saw cuts in my thumbs. And the feeling I got doing woodworking, where you have to really carefully plan out how all the pieces are going to fit together. But then once you start constructing, then you have to improvise because the pieces are not going to fit together exactly as you anticipated. That is so similar and almost like pushes the same buttons as web product development, where you envision a feature and you think, all right, this is how I want the feature to work and this is how I want users to interact with the feature. And then once you actually start building and coding and seeing users interact with the feature, everything changes and you've got to improvise. But all along the way, just the sort of base thrill of building and making is there. So I feel the exact same way that I did when I was woodworking in kindergarten.
Your students who helped you write those thousands of letters illicitly to the alumni networks of Yale and St. Paul's School, they're over a decade, you know, out of high school now. They're adults. Do you have a sense of what they're doing?
Yeah. Oh, I have students, former students who are doing all sorts of awesome things. I get to keep in touch with them through Facebook. A number of them have volunteered or interned or worked at DonorsChoose.org. One is a social worker. One was a Gates scholar who got a full scholarship to Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, which is one of the top engineering schools. I have students who are doing great things.
Do you feel that you are a Mr. Buxton to some of those students?
Not quite a Mr. Buxton. Mr. Buxton was I'm certain, even more of an inspiration to his students than I was to mine. But hopefully I'm fractionally a Mr. Buxton.
Well, thanks very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Jessica.
My guest has been Charles Best, founder of Donors Choose. Coming up, we'll meet Lyndon Rive, co-founder of Solar City. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Lyndon Rive, co-founder of Solar City, a clean energy company that sells solar energy to consumers. Solar City manufactures, finances, and installs solar panels for homes, schools, and businesses across the United States. Solar City has installed solar panels for companies including Walmart, Intel, and eBay, among others. Lyndon founded the company with his brother Pete in 2006. Solar City went public in December 2012. Lyndon is a former ballroom dance instructor and member of the U.S. national underwater hockey team. He is from Pretoria, South Africa. Welcome.
Welcome. Thank you. Thanks for having me. The ballroom dance instructor, how did you get that one?
Well, tell me how you became one.
When I was 12, actually, my aunt had a ballroom studio, and when you teach ballroom, the women's feet and the men's feet are the opposites of one another. So I helped her out with teaching out the men's feet.
In addition to the ballroom dancing, at 17, you started your first company. It was a homeopathics company selling remedies for arthritis and constipation, among other things. Do you still use homeopathic remedies in your life?
I don't use it as much, but I do focus on good eating. Mm-hmm. So make sure you get 2 green shakes every day, stay away from sweets, and do exercise, stay healthy. I still play underwater hockey.
How long are you able to hold your breath?
You know, it's I can probably hold my breath about 2 minutes, but the trick about underwater hockey is repeating the breath holding for 30 minutes.
You joined the National Underwater Hockey Team in the United States after you came to the U.S. to start a software business with your brother Russell. And it was your underwater hockey that actually helped you stay in the United States. Can you describe what happened there?
Both my wife and I are South African. I met my wife when I was 14 years old. So I came over first. I wanted to get the business established. Then she came over. Her visa expired before mine, and she figured out that there's a category called exceptional ability. It's an O visa.
Exceptional ability.
Any person that is exceptionally good at something, the U.S. wants you, but they can't discriminate. So my wife and I are actually really good at underwater hockey. She got her green card by being exceptionally good at underwater hockey. And then that's how I was able to stay in the country. Mm-hmm. The fact that I was employing 280 people, had a $100 million company, I still couldn't get a green card. I was about to get deported. There's a lot of work there to be done if somebody who can play underwater hockey can stay in the country, but someone who starts a company cannot.
You ultimately sold the company to Dell in 2007. And before this time, you were noodling on what your next endeavor would be. And you came upon the idea for Solar City in the car going to Burning Man, which is in Nevada. How would you describe Burning Man?
It is a big party in the middle of the desert where there is nothing. So everybody brings everything with them. And then they leave, leaving no footprint. So that's the whole key.
And it was on your way to Burning Man when your cousin, the tech entrepreneur Elon Musk, came up with the idea to dabble in solar. Can you describe that car ride?
Elon and I, of course, we know each other as we are cousins. Our mothers are twins, and so we go back quite a bit. And he actually invested into Everdream, the software company. And so we actually started learning one another from a business side, not just from a personal side. So I was describing to Elon that I want to start a new business. And so it was his idea that, you know, he said, we'll get into the solar industry. And then I came back, discussed it with Peter, the second oldest brother. I'm the third one. And he instantly fell in love with the idea.
Could you describe how Solar City works?
The simple description of Solar City is that we are an energy company. We install the solar system in your house. We install it for free. You don't pay for the equipment. You don't pay for the installation. You don't pay for the service. The only thing you pay for is the electricity that the system produces. And you pay less for that electricity than what you would pay from the utility. So given the choice of paying more for dirty power or paying less for clean power, most of our customers, of course, prefer to pay less for clean power.
Since you are undertaking the whole installation process for consumers, it's a highly capital-intensive endeavor. And I want to talk about raising capital in the early days. You had the benefit of your cousin being on board, because it's kind of like by the guy, where venture capitalists will want to come on board with somebody as successful as he. Can you describe capital raising in the early days?
So remember, this is back in 2006. So Elon's success was well known back then, but it was primarily based on PayPal, not yet to be determined on SpaceX or Tesla. Elon absolutely did help, but it wasn't easy. A common question we would get is, how can we justify investing in this when there's already 4,000 other solar installers in the country at that time? The primary vision was describing what was wrong with the model. Everybody was selling solar equipment. They weren't selling solar energy. There has to be a whole transformation that occurs. You have to change out the energy infrastructure. You have to deliver renewable energy, but you're not going to do this if the consumer has to pay for the capital. So you have to just sell the electricity, the electrons.
And who were one or two investors that kind of served as critical allies for you?
So Draper Fisher and Jeveston goes back right to the beginning. They're the guys who gave me my first $2 million check when I was 22 years old. In the software company that manages PCs. But they've actually invested in every single financial round that I have raised. And that's like 30 or 40 different investments.
Here's a guy who sold homeopathic remedies, who's, you know, now selling solar. What to you has been or was most surprising about getting the company off the ground, more challenging than you had expected?
When I got into the business, I felt that the solar industry really had some anger towards the utility industry. And I was like, you know, that doesn't feel right. Like, the utilities can't be that bad. They can't be fighting you that much. because all the media you see shows that the utility industry is very supportive of renewable energy. They do these campaigns of, you know, go green, be energy efficient. So clearly this is a misconception. Nope, it's not. Majority of the utility industry is fighting it tooth and nail.
And what's an example of your being face-to-face with the utility in a particular state?
A classic one would be California. When the solar industry started launching, the solar industry wanted a 0.25% net metering cap. So what a net metering cap is, it allows the homeowner to move the electricity back into the grid so the utility can sell it to the neighbor. And the utility industry said that if we allow a 0.25% cap, it will destroy the entire financial stability of the grid. When reality is actually there's many benefits associated with generating electricity during peak periods, during the day when the sun's, you know, shining on the panels and where most of the energy is needed.
What is an example of one or two utility companies that have been on the other side and have been friendly to your presence?
PG&E, as an example, a utility in California, one of the largest ones, they've invested over $300 million into our solar assets. Their previous CEO, Peter Darby, came from PacBow, and he told me that he saw what the cell phone did to the landline industry.
I want to speak briefly about tax credits. You rely heavily on them in terms of offering lower costs to your consumers. How do you navigate those issues?
Every energy sector has had significant tax credits, but the amount of credits that the solar industry gets is significantly less than what the fossil fuel industry gets. But even with that, we're going to get to a point where we can provide energy at a lower cost than fossil fuel can without credits. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be an unfair playing field, as they will still have their credits. We won't have ours, and we'll still beat them.
And why don't you have yours? Is it just the entrenchment of you two?
So you're dealing with entrenched industries that have been around for 50 to 100 years, and the subsidies go so, so deep. He has a classic subsidy that bugs me. One of our biggest costs in installing solar is the permitting. It's not that the permit itself is expensive. It's the time delay of getting the permit. Mm. So imagine you're driving on a highway, and then there was a stop, mm-hmm. and a dead stop where you actually have to get out of your car, the inspector looks in the car, and then you can go again. How big do you think the traffic jam would be? So that's what permitting does to the solar industry. It creates a traffic jam. The fossil fuel industry in California as well as in Texas, you don't need a permit. In Texas, an example, it's faster to get a fracking permit. And I'm not sure if you've seen a fracking facility. It's horrendous than it is to get a solar permit for your house.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Lyndon Rive, co-founder of Solar City. Solar City has installed systems for several hundred schools and universities, the U.S. military, and companies including Intel and eBay and Walmart. You're becoming more vertically integrated. Are you surprised by how vertically integrated you have to be in order to make the system as seamless and low cost as possible? Did you imagine that when you were first starting the company?
So when we launched the company, we thought, you know, the first one thing that we'll do is we'll do the customer education and we'll do the customer acquisition, but we'll outsource the installation,
right,
and have somebody else do that. Terrible customer experience. So we quickly knew that we had to vertically integrate the installation business.
Which means your need for capital.
So we had to raise a lot of capital to be able to do that. So we took the harder path, but we knew that the harder path would yield a better result. Then the next one we integrated was our financing. So instead of going to a third party to finance the asset, and then the customer not knowing who they're working with, are they working with the installer or are they working with the financial institution? You know, who do they complain when there's a problem? So then we integrated the financials. So it's just one company you have to deal with. Then we looked at our cost and realized that, well, if we further vertically integrate the mounting hardware, we can improve the aesthetic issues. This mounting hardware that we bought improves the aesthetics dramatically. And now the next phase is integrating the actual manufacturing of the modules.
What companies did you look to in the early days that echoed what you were trying to do, not necessarily in the energy industry, but outside?
We wanted to create the experience no different than signing up for a cell phone plan or getting DirecTV. But there weren't many. In fact, this was a big criticism that we got in trying to raise capital, as there's not one single company that we could point to that has vertically integrated in our consumer business model.
I want to talk about the need to educate the consumer in the early days, because you don't have just a new service, but you're pioneering an industry. How did relationships with Home Depot or Best Buy help in that education?
Education is still our biggest challenge. I've just witnessed this recently. A friend of mine knows that I'm in this business. He comes to me and goes, just bought a house. I'm ready to get a solar system. What's the payback? And I almost wanted to punch him. I was like, how can you ask me what the payback is? I've been in this business for such a long time. You know I've been in this business. There is no payback. You just pay less for the electricity.
What did he mean by what's the payback?
Most consumers out there still think you have to buy the equipment, and then you look at what is the payback of the energy savings on the investment.
And you said, no, I'm installing for free.
The installation's free, the equipment's free, everything's free. You just pay for the energy and you pay less from the utility. That is our biggest challenge. So partnerships like Home Depot and Best Buy have helped tremendously. Because someone's going to Home Depot, they're not going there to buy solar. They're going there to go buy dirt or something for their house. Then we are there. The person walks by and we say, hey, would you like to save money on your utility bill? And they go, what are you talking about? Well, we can install the system for free, and we sell you the energy at a lower rate than the utility. And then the next question is, I don't get it. What's the catch?
Well, how much pushback are you getting just because it's sort of not in my own backyard? Like, while I like the idea of solar, I don't want an ugly panel on my roof. Some might think it's pretty, but others might not.
Yeah, in new markets where solar is extremely new, it's not that solar is ugly. It's just new. Of course, I'm slightly biased. I think it's jewelry for your house. It's more good-looking than any air conditioning units. It's more good-looking than the power lines coming to your house. And the power lines are ugly. So it's just that it's new. It's almost like the Prius. When the Prius first came out, it was an ugly-looking car. Now, I can say it because I actually bought a Prius shortly after it came out. But once it became understood that that's the shape and the practicality of the shape, it became one of the most successful cars out there.
Speaking of cars, you also own a Tesla, the electric car company founded by your cousin Elon. And I want to talk about Elon. I read somewhere that you've called him the chosen one.
I've called him Neo. In the Matrix, if you watch the Matrix, Neo is the chosen one. The reason for that is he sees all the zeros and ones. When working with Elon, he can quickly identify where the mistakes are and help us avoid those mistakes. And the way I often describe it is he will say, turn right into the pothole so that you can miss the invisible wall. And I'm like, but I don't want to hit the pothole. And he goes, well, you'd be way better off hitting the pothole than hitting the invisible wall. So then you just turn right, you hit the pothole, creates a little bump, and then in the rear mirror, you see the invisible wall. And you go, wow, I'm glad I did not hit that invisible wall. But he just has the ability to see things that most cannot.
What was your view of him as you were growing up?
He was always extremely driven. A lot of the other students would beat him up for just being so smart. He was the first one to leave South Africa. He was the first one to start a software company, Zip2. It's often the company no one speaks about, but he sold it for $300 million.
What did it do?
It was almost a combination of MapQuest and Yellow Pages on the internet. He sold it to Compaq.
How about you? You know, you said that he was kind of a social outcast a little bit growing up. How about you?
I started my first company at 17, so I missed all the social activities. I was working 80 hours at a young age and going to high school. So, in fact, I didn't attend my last year of high school. I almost got expelled.
And your mom was pretty dogmatic about your working.
Yes, this is an incredible mother. Would you allow your kid to start a company in the last year of high school and then have them devote all their time on that company and not go to high school?
The homeopathic company.
Yeah, the homeopathic company. So it takes a certain parent to do that.
How much were you making from this company?
I was doing extremely well, but my principal wanted to expel me. I went to him and showed him my financials, and he realized that this would be more money than most people will ever make. And we made a deal that he would allow me to write the exams, but I don't have to go to school.
You're dyslexic, is that right?
I am. I struggle with reading and writing.
How has that helped you, do you think?
It's been a total pain to deal with. You just read contracts slower, so it's a little annoying sometimes.
So you feel like it's been more of a detriment?
The help is, often you can either be viewed as a victim and go, okay, this is the reason why I have failed. Or you can just go, okay, I'm not good at that. What are all the things that I can do to supplement that weakness? I knew that academics is not something I'd strive in, so that's why I started my first company at 17. It has allowed me to develop a strong sense for business. It has allowed me to develop a good way of communicating because I rely on oral communication a lot more than writing communication. It has allowed me to persevere through very, very difficult times. I think it has helped me.
Yeah.
But given the choice of having or not having, I'd prefer not to have it.
You have two boys. How do you explain to them what you do for a living?
So it's tough. But the area that we focused on is saving the planet. So they call me Captain Planet, trying to justify the reasons why I'm not always at home. The other day, my kid came to him and said, "Ryan's dad's often at home. Why aren't you at home?" And I have to explain to him that, I'm trying to save the planet.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest has been Captain Planet Lyndon Rive, co-founder of SolarCity.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.